awesome. Consider a pitch to Awesome Kingston to win one of our $1,000 no strings attached micro grants. You can pitch at awesomekingston.org. Proposals are due the first Sunday of every month, and selected pitches are heard the third Thursday of every month. Once again, pitch your awesome ideas at awesomekingston.org.
Great. Well, hello, everyone. It's wonderful to be here together on this beautiful January day. And just before coming here, the three of us were enjoying a meal at Jess's house just down the lake. And as we were driving here, we were commenting on how beautiful the lake looks right now. With the kind of jagged ice coming out of it, and parts of it are open and flowing. And I have this book here with me called Conversations with the Kagawong River. And something that Jenny and Jess and I have been thinking a lot about together is this question of how do we listen? How do we listen? And I think that question can be asked, how do we listen to one another as people? But this book and kind of what we're interested in too is how do we listen across species? When we have these quite fundamental differences to ourselves. And I wanted to read a few words in Anishinaabemowin from this book to kind of get us grounded in this space here where we're gathering in Anishinaabe territories, shared with Haudenosaunee Confederacy territories. And so I invite you for a moment. You can close your eyes, you can sit back, relax, and just kind of let some of these land-based, water-based words wash over you. Baboon, all winter. Beinidjuan, to flow along. Begushknasin, to decompose. Debushka, to be low grass. Gaming, the lake shore. Jidmo, squirrel. Aki, land, ground, earth. Kanonan Wawash Geshuan, she or he is speaking to the deer. Mekomiwabo, ice water. Nikwetegwea, where the rivers meet. Nibika, to be a watery place. Nigikowa, I discovered tracks of somebody. Shignawashug, earthworms. Shkagamikwe, Mother Earth. Thank you. So I want to say just a few words to introduce our honored guest here, Professor Jenny Nadelsky. And Jenny is someone who I think kind of defies introductions. I want to introduce her first as someone who is uniquely humble in her curiosity for the world. She always seems to kind of approach questions from a place of being totally open to moving herself from one place into another place by the time the conversation ends. And it reminds me kind of being around a child where you can really kind of see them forming themselves. And I think that it's one of the most phenomenal things to witness in someone. And I really admire and appreciate that. Jenny has held teaching positions, professorships at the University of Toronto, at Osgoode. She's been at Princeton. You were at Dalhousie for a spell as well. So she's been across these sort of institutional spaces as well as disciplinary spaces. She's someone who's very grounded in constitutional law, comparative constitutional law, feminist legal theory, care ethics, labor studies. She is increasingly interested in, I think, questions of ecology and how this intersects with her work. And I'm excited to see where her work continues to grow. And it's an honor to be here together today for this conversation on Part-Time for All. So we'll pass it over to you.
Thank you for that lovely introduction. And indeed, I'm now working on a project inspired by a workshop that these two set up on more than human constitutionalism. And there was a moment when I thought, well, you know, my interests are really shifting. I finished the Part-Time for All book, and now I'm going back to rethinking the meaning of property as care for the land and more than human. But actually, even though this book is very focused on the relation between work and care, it's really more and more clear to me that care matters to all of us, that we aren't going to figure out how to relate well to all our relations unless we can do it with a caring spirit. So I want to start with some quotes from the preface to the book. One of the most important insights I got from having my children was the importance of routine physical caretaking for forming the basic bonds of connection. That initial insight broadened into a belief that physical caretaking is part of what roots us in the world and permits us to feel a connection with the material foundations of life, from the care the earth requires to respect for the labor that permits us to live as we do. The dominant culture of North America treats virtually all forms of physical caretaking with contempt. Until there is a shift in this basic stance, those who do the caretaking will be treated with contempt. They will be paid little and defined as unsuccessful. If caretaking were actually valued, there would be a revolution in the structure of our society. So I wrote those sentences in 1998. And now, together with Tom Mallison, I offer a path to that transformation. Our book is about new norms that could restructure our lives so that everyone, no matter how important their work, experiences the joy and connection of caregiving, both physical and emotional. The norm that we propose would be that all who are able provide roughly 20 to 25 hours of unpaid care every week, an amount sufficient for them to acquire the knowledge and connection that care brings. The need to learn from care grounds our argument that everyone needs to do it. And this, of course, is one of the most contentious arguments in the book. And so I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk more about it, and I'll come back to it at the very end. In addition, roughly 30 hours a week would be the upper end of the norm for paid work. We think these profound changes could have vitally important impacts, ending the unsustainable stress on families and the gross inequality for those who provide care. It would ensure that high-level decision makers know something about care, and those who know something about care could become policymakers. Even if caregivers were respected and well compensated, if one group of people makes the policy in both corporations and government and a different group provides the care, we'll continue to have dangerously ignorant policymakers. Part-time for all could end the long-standing degradation of care and those who do it, as well as the policy distortions that flow from failing to recognize the value of care. Now, as we were completing this book, the global pandemic struck. COVID-19 should have made it brutally obvious that people cannot get their work done unless somebody is available to provide care. And even though that fact somehow never really sunk in at the level of the policy world, I still think that there's no better time than now to pose the fundamental question: what happens to care when the demands of the workplace ignore the need for care? Getting people back to work as we knew it, which was the mantra for some time, will not address this vital question. Work relies on care, but care is becoming unsustainable because of the structure of work and the ongoing failure to value care. Who's supposed to provide care for those who need it when the ideal worker is still someone whose top priority is work. Better publicly funded care for children, the elderly, and people with disabilities is urgently needed. But none of that will solve the underlying problems of workplace demands that are incompatible with care and with a pervasive degradation of care and those who do it. It will not solve the problem of policymakers ignorant about care. This book presents the argument that the problems of care, its low status and its unequal distribution, cannot be fixed without changing the structure of work. By reducing work hours across the board, with no exceptions for important jobs at the top, individuals, families, and societies will reap the benefits of a revaluation of care and of a population all of whom has learned the joys, the skills, and the dispositions of care by doing it. Now, I just want to note that I think this conversation about rethinking care and work, restructuring it, seeing that the two always go together and both have to be changed, that is a conversation that should happen everywhere in the world. But the particular solution that we're proposing here is aimed at wealthy countries. So we're not claiming that it would work immediately in countries where with high levels of poverty. So now I'm going to give you a very brief summary of the book. First, I'll just note that the terms work and care are essential to the structure of the argument, how to redo both of them. But at some level, those terms are arbitrary, right? Anyone who does care work knows it involves work. And if you think about it, good work should involve care. So the terms are necessary, but at some level arbitrary. And we think the more these norms would take hold, the more the distinctions would become fuzzy. It would be hard to tell what counts as which. So there are many vital issues confronting contemporary societies. Our book is focused on four specific but interlocking problems. The first is that of stressed families. In other words, the unsustainable structure of work and family life that puts enormous stress on families and forces many people, particularly but not exclusively women, into untenable choices between work and family. Bridget Schulte, a really interesting journalist who's written a great book on these issues, has poignantly described the widespread feeling, he's talking about women who are trying to both run families and work, sometimes from the workplace, I mean, it's from the home, as being constantly overwhelmed, of always doing more than one thing at a time, what she calls fractured time and how disorienting and destructive of that, and of always being behind and always late. And I think increasingly this is something everyone recognizes, not just people who are at working and taking care of young children. A second major problem is that of inequality. The provision of care is organized around hierarchical lines. The most obvious category which care is organized is around, of course, gender. But increasingly, it's obvious that gender intersects with other categories such as race, class, and citizenship status. Those on top, rich white men, do very little care. The key point here is that as long as care remains stigmatized, as long as powerful men do very little of it, and poor women do the bulk of it, society will continue to be profoundly unequal in terms of status and economic well-being. In some audiences, I say, you know, even if you don't care about family or gender equality, even if you just think you're interested in equality, you can't get an equal society if you don't fix this problem. A third problem is what we refer to as the care policy divide, the thing that I think is the least talked about in the care literature generally. And that is, those in top policymaking positions in government or business are almost always people with very little concrete experience of the demands, satisfactions, and importance of caregiving. This means that policymakers are, for the most part, ignorant of a core dimension of human life. This basically renders them unfit for the job. We should no more consider electing someone without substantial experience in caregiving to public office or appointing them CEO of a corporation than we would someone who had never held a job. Our claim is that the knowledge of care is essential to good policymaking in all spheres, not just, you know, childcare, but housing, transportation, education. The necessary knowledge can only be acquired by doing a substantial amount of hands-on caregiving. The final problem, which intersects with all of the above, is that of time scarcity. Just one statistic across the OECD, 17% of men work over 50 hours per week. In Europe, the average woman in a couple with children works a massive 71 hours each week when you include her unpaid care work. The roots of these four problems are, of course, complex, but there are two fundamental causes. The first is the dominant norms of who is expected to do care and who gets a pass, that's Joan Trano's terms, from this core human responsibility. Who are the people who nobody even thinks ought to be doing it? The second is the economic system, which particularly in neoliberal countries generates widespread economic insecurity. The only real path to economic security is becoming an ideal worker, someone willing to work full time and who can displace family and care obligations to the margins of their life or onto the shoulders of others. Our book is aimed at the kind of fundamental change that could actually address these deep systemic problems at their roots. Our proposal is part-time for all. In essence, our proposal is that we need a dramatic change in the dominant norms of who does care work. And second, we need a complementary set of changes to our workplaces in order to foster and facilitate a more equitable distribution of care. So let me say a few words about both sides of the proposal. We think the heart of the solution must be new norms that everyone is responsible for providing care. Our proposal is that all capable adults should be expected to perform significant amounts of care work, no matter who you are or how important your work is. Even if you're a preeminent surgeon or all-star athlete or senior executive, everyone should be doing substantial care, and likewise, everyone should work part-time, that is, no more than 30 hours a week. I should say that in the book, we take some time to explain that there are many jobs that require periods of intensity. So if you're a lawyer and you're on a big case, there may be a stretch of time, it could even be months, where you can't meet these commitments, or you're doing overseas aid work. But when you come back, whenever that particular assignment is over, you make that time up in care. So it's not that we say we can get rid of all of this intensity. You just have to build in compensation. And our argument is also that practically everyone is capable of learning how to provide decent quality care. There are lots of different ways of providing care. And moreover, everyone needs to experience substantial amounts of care work in order to reap the benefits that come from it. So the project is to radically change the norms of who does care. People would encourage one another to resist the pressure of taking on more work, and support and appreciate the care that they do. Now, while we advocate support, not shame, we do expect that if these norms took hold, announcing the failure to meet the norms, say by working long hours or refusing to participate in care, if you were to tell somebody that, it would generate the sort of concern, disapproval, embarrassment, pity, or unease that would currently arise if a competent adult male announced at a party that he had never held a job. The concept of the workaholic, which has become actually a term of pride in some contexts, would actually be treated as the disease that it is. As with current gender norms, people would feel some pressure to conform, but these are norms, not laws. There would be no bureaucracy to measure care. No one would go to jail for working more than 30 hours or be fined for failing to change their fair share of diapers. On this model, the responsibility of care for care is lifelong. It does not follow the current arc of life stages, intense when children are young or parents are elderly. It continues over your whole life. So when you're in those periods when your kids don't require as intense care, your parents are still healthy, then we envision, we have a whole chunk of explanation about this, that people create communities of care, relatively small, somewhere between 15 and 50 people, who form long-term serious commitments to mutual care. And we also have a section short in this book, longer in future things to come, that care for the earth is an important part of these obligations. And for similar reasons, that we think that you can't learn what you need to know about the ways in which we receive care from the earth and therefore have a mutual obligation to provide care. You can't get that knowledge except experientially. Now, for part-time for all to be feasible, the central economic requirement is that everyone has to have access to good part-time jobs. By this, we mean jobs that are secure, flexible, and high quality. High quality meaning that they provide decent pay and benefits that are proportional to what is now traditional full-time work in good jobs. In particular, for part-time work to be at all attractive to people, it needs to be reinforced by economic security. One way of thinking about that is a living wage defined as what one person and a child can comfortably live on at 30 hours a week. Guaranteed annual income could play a role. In the end, Tom and I had slightly different views on this, and we realized that different countries will handle the problem of economic security differently. And so this book doesn't plonk down for one particular path, but recognizes that without it, the whole project will only be available to people who already have a reasonable level of economic security. And I should say it's increasingly obvious that the solution to the housing crisis is going to have to be part of this picture of living off of 30 hours a week, but that is outside what the book tries to do. Now, none of these things fully exist in the Anglo world, but the kinds of economic structures that it requires are not at all utopian. Many of the elements already exist in various countries, particularly Western Northern Europe. For example, in the Netherlands, a massive 47% of the labor force is engaged in part-time work. It's the world's first part-time economy, and this includes high-level jobs of management, law. It is, however, highly gendered still. A disproportionate number of women constitute that 47%. And we have good reason to believe that it's possible to provide robust economic security. In Denmark, a single mother working 30 hours per week on minimum wage would earn about 22,000 euro, whereas a living wage is only 14,000 euro. This, of course, does not hold for New York City or Toronto. In sum, we argue that a society of part-time for all could be viably built on four main pillars: quality part-time work, flexibility, what we prefer to call time sovereignty, economic security, and fully care-friendly policies. Such a society does not currently exist anywhere in the world, but we demonstrate in the book that each and every one of the components do. We know that each pillar is feasible as it already exists in some form, and there's no reason why the pillars could not be combined. This is the essential realism of what is often thought of as a utopian project. We are not advocating institutions that are unknown or untried. If we can overcome the standard but very real political difficulties of electing care-friendly governments — I'm saying the world does not seem to be going in that direction — part-time for all is an entirely practical project. It's institutionally sound, economically affordable, ecologically sustainable, and capable of withstanding the pressures of globalization. So now I just have some closing remarks that put this particularly in the context of law and of other high status, long hours professions. So first, the distinction between work and care is arbitrary, as I mentioned. I think this is particularly important for lawyers to be thinking about the way in which care should be part of their work, including mentoring for clients and care for themselves. Second, the point that I mentioned at the outset: everyone needs to do care in order to learn from care. And one of the things, just to note, one of the things that people do learn from doing care is the capacity to take the perspectives of others, because you cannot care well for anyone if you can't take their perspective. And this perspective taking is very important for judgment, which of course is central to law. And I just want to again note one thing when around the anxiety, but why does everyone have to do that? Why? What if, you know, care just isn't your thing? And I realized that nobody in our culture says, well, you know, work is not my thing. You know, I don't like taking orders. I don't like having to be somewhere every day. It's, you know, really not my kind of thing. Nobody takes that seriously. Now, maybe we should take it a little more seriously. You know, some of the guaranteed income for all people really want the libertarian vision. But what's really we have to bear in mind is we think this, oh, but it's not my personal style and preference and temperament, works for the care. Why I shouldn't have to do any of that in ways that is completely not transferable to arguments about work. But every society needs what we sometimes call reproductive labor, the care work of the world, and productive labor. Every society needs both. We should all be doing both. The division of labor has been destructive. So reasonable hours. This is an important thing to say to lawyers and future lawyers, probably sadly academics too these days. It's possible in all these fields. There are two very good books. I don't have the details here, but they're cited in the book about how you can design law firms around reasonable hours, even though many lawyers will tell you that this is simply not possible. And many people in all these high status fields will say, oh, but excellence would be sacrificed if people didn't pump out these long hours. And really, I want to say from personal experience, I just retired for the second time. And so I have been working, I think, almost part-time by these norms. I like my work. I enjoy it so much more. And I think it's better and more creative. I absolutely believe that the grueling long hours is not a path to creativity. We have actually quite a bit of evidence of that. And it's not a path to what actually should count as excellence. So it is true that one of the things that's built into this is a redefinition of excellence and success. And that's what makes people so anxious, is that they can tell that this model is a threat to what currently counts as excellence and success. But we should not accept those definitions. So last point here is that the high status of many professions exacerbates a more general issue. Part of the way we're all trained to think that work is more important than care is that in our culture, the scope and scale of the impact of what we do is in an inverse relation to intimate relations and direct care. So if you're a CEO, even of a really good NGO, you're not actually doing the on-the-ground work, but you are more important. You are seen to be having higher impact. And in Western societies, success is almost always coded as being high up a hierarchy of power and impact. And care is the opposite. Care is small scale. It won't have the kind of large-scale impact. And I think this is part of why some people are resistant to the proposal of part-time for all, to limit paid work to a maximum of 30 hours a week, and not to let even activism interfere with a core commitment of 22 hours a week of direct care. I think it looks to them like too much important high-impact work or its excellence would be sacrificed to low-impact, small-scale care. But I think most humans thrive best and learn what they need to know to support good values in their communities if they're regularly involved in both direct care and in activities at larger scales, where they can feel their contribution on a wider scale. Under our current structures of work and degradation of care, people are forced into a choice between those. Part-time for all would go a long way to redress that. It would also put us on a path to a deeper change, one necessary to redress climate change and more generally for good government. I believe we need an overarching change in stance toward life that connects the issues of scale, care, and relationship with the tasks of collective cooperation. Good collective decision-making is not likely to be fostered by a norm of tension and stress for those delegated to do this work, either in the daily form of carrying out policies or adjudicating disputes or deciding on the laws, policies, or norms that are to organize collective life. The dominant picture of the busy, important person must give way to forms of human interaction that are slow enough reflective enough, relationally connected enough to foster not only clear creative thinking, but a stance of care and compassion toward one's coworkers and towards those who will be affected by one's decisions. Part-time for all, which can be advocated for right now, will lead us in that direction. Thank you.
Well, welcome everyone, both here in the room and online, to this year's Law 80 lecture in business law. The topic of today's talk involves the flow of funds, but the focus, I think, on illicit funds around the globe. And advances in technology increasingly disconnect capital from a particular place, for better or for worse. And I think can also make us as human beings feel disconnected from the physical earth and a particular place. So I think it's useful to start by grounding ourselves in this place by showing respect to the original and continuing stewards of this land. And we do so by acknowledging that the land on which those of us in the room gather today on Queen's University campus is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Haudenosaunee. And we are grateful to be able to share this talk with you today from this territory. The Law 80 lecture is an annual event funded by a generous gift from the Queen's Law Class of 1980. And I'm thrilled that some members of the Law 80 Committee are joining us today for the talk via Zoom. If you are joining us on Zoom, when we get to the Q&A portion, please type your questions in the Q&A box and I'll monitor that. The topic of money laundering has increasingly moved, I think, from criminal law and conversations about organized crime to corporate law in the boardrooms of Bay Street. In October last year, TD Bank pled guilty to criminal charges in the U.S. related to money laundering. And the guilty pleas by TD Bank made headlines around the world and especially here in Canada. And so I thought it would be a fitting and timely topic for this year's lecture. And I'm thrilled that one of Canada's leading legal experts on money laundering, Dr. Sana Ahmed, is this year's Law 80 lecturer. Dr. Ahmed is an assistant professor of law at the University of Calgary. She, as I mentioned, she's an expert on money laundering and she teaches and researches on this topic. More generally, Dr. Ahmed's interdisciplinary research examines the regulatory, constitutional, and governance issues at the heart of global regulation. She is also a contributor to the book, Dirty Money, Financial Crime in Canada, edited by Queen's Professor Christian Loprecht, who's also here with us today. And thanks to an arrangement with the publisher, the book is available to anyone as a free download from QSpace. Prior to joining the University of Calgary, Dr. Ahmed was a Killam postdoctoral fellow at Dalhousie University. She's a PhD from Osgoode Hall Law School, an LLM from the University of Warwick, and a BA LLB from the University of Karachi. And prior to pursuing a career as a legal academic, Dr. Ahmed was an editor, writer, producer, and reporter for several media outlets in Pakistan, including BBC Urdu Service. And so now she's on the other side of the mic and the pen, so to speak, as a frequent media commentator and speaker. So please join me in welcoming Professor Ahmed to Queen's Law.
Thank you so much, Gail, for that very generous introduction. I'm thrilled to be here to be talking about TD, which is obviously, as Gail mentioned, it's been in the news for a while now. I wanted to begin today's talk with a confession. As a former journalist, I am rarely caught completely off guard. When the TD story broke in May last year, I predicted much of what we've seen since. We saw some corporate reorganization. We've seen a few mea culpas. We've seen jail time for a few employees. And we've seen a host of red-faced Canadian regulators. The only thing that truly surprised me about the TD story was the level of surprise that the TD story evokes across Canada. And the only thing that worries me is how this reaction of surprise is shaping the narrative about both money laundering in Canada as well as the legal landscape. Let me unpack these two claims. The Oxford Dictionary tells us that surprise is something that is unexpected or an astonishing event, fact, or thing. The second largest bank in the country getting hauled up for laundering would be an unexpected or astonishing event only if it had never happened before. What you see up on the screen is a snapshot of Canadian banking history that shows us that many others have been here before. So RBC, BMO, CIBC, Nova Scotia, as well as a bunch of smaller outfits, Exchange Bank of Canada, HSBC Canada, all these banks have either laundered money or they've had deficiencies in their anti-money laundering, or the acronym is AML, in their AML frameworks. So, is it truly surprising that TD has joined the ranks of the others comprising the Big Five? Or to flip this question on its head, what was it about TD that made us think it would remain an outlier? Now, let's ground these developments in the broader Canadian context. For at least 10 years now, Canada has made headlines as a premier onshore destination for laundered monies from across the world. Now, during this time, a bunch of developments have shown us repeatedly laundering is not an isolated one-off phenomenon, which is restricted to biker gangs or fentanyl smugglers. Laundering happens to be a system. Conceived, it would qualify as an industry in its own right. Now, this snapshot runs us through the major laundering-related events in the last 10 years. So, some of you may remember the 2015 Charbonneau Commission inquiry into corruption in the construction industry in Quebec. And the standout finding there was that mafia-type criminal organizations had long-standing relationships with politicians, big business, and service industry professionals. That would include lawyers, accountants, those kinds of people. Laundering was just how the industry worked. Meanwhile, between 2016 and 2021, we had the Panama and Pandora Papers, which revealed a flourishing made-in-Canada laundering industry. Now, the phrase snowwashing, as opposed to the relatively pedestrian term laundering, the phrase snowwashing was made by us, for us. In 2017, we heard about the Vancouver model of laundering, which happened at casinos in BC. In 2022, the Cullen Commission inquiry told us that while the Vancouver model was breaking news to many of us, gaming regulators in the province had known about the phenomenon for at least 7-8 years before we found out. Similarly, when the Toronto method of mortgage fraud was unearthed at HSBC Canada, we discovered that while we were finding about it thanks to a whistleblower within HSBC Canada, the fraud had been operative for 8-9 years by then. Meanwhile, we've got a FinTrack report. FinTrack, by the way, that's the Canadian AML supervisor. We've got a FinTrack report from 2023-24 that says most banking and real estate companies do not adhere to AML regulations. So to come back to the original question, a Canadian bank laundering should then be no shocker by Canadian standards. But now let's just zoom out a bit further. This is one of my favorite slides ever, and I use it frequently. It's one of my favorite slides because, as you see on this, these are not two-bit, fly-by-night kind of operators. For the most part, they are solid, stolid global financial institutions that either undertook laundering or decided to ignore it or decided not to look for it. And sometimes they did that repeatedly. Given this, why are we surprised that TD had been laundering for 10 years? If anything, we should be surprised it had been laundering for only 10 years. The reason I'm worried about the surprised reaction to TD Bank, the reason I'm worried is because of what this surprise signals about the state of understanding of money laundering as a phenomenon within Canada. When TD happened, as you can imagine, most media outlets were looking for commentators, and I was one of the people approached. Except almost without exception, everyone wanted a soundbite about how terrible TD was, how Canadian regulators were caught napping at the wheel, and how ashamed Canada should be because US regulators had caught them napping. We're all good Canadians, so we have this instinct to self-flagellate and apologize. But this instinct needn't override our common sense. TD laundered, as many other banks do and continue doing. They laundered because it's profitable for them to do so. TD is not the exception, it is the rule. Banks are financial intermediaries, and the profit imperative, the desire to make profits, is central to their function. Laundering drugs proceeds or avoiding sanctions, avoiding taxes, helping with capital flight from countries such as China. All these activities, they generate profits for financial institutions. When we ignore this central principle behind a bank's operation, when we expect a bank to self-police its profit-generating activities, it's akin to asking a pedophile to self-regulate. It's too much of an ask. We've seen this previously with casinos in BC. Nobody, including the government-appointed regulators, were willing to say no to obviously dodgy money. We are talking about hockey bags full of cash that were coming into casinos in BC that the gaming regulators had known about for 7-8 years and decided to say nothing about. And the reason they didn't do so is because the political economy of the city, of the province, and even of the country is linked to that money was useful and it was relied upon. And so it is with banks. Money deposits are what enable banks to continue with their real business, which is financial intermediation. They pick up deposits from certain lots of people and they pass it around to other lots of people, and they charge their financial intermediation fees for it. That's their core business. And AML compliance, or even fines and penalties, in the larger structure of how banking is conducted, AML compliance, fines and penalties, they are rationalized as the cost of doing business. Now, obviously, this is not to say that banks deliberately seek out drugs money or trafficking proceeds. It's just that more is more. Bear in mind, we are also talking about an industry which is where you see continued employment, promotions, bonuses. All of these rewards are linked to the generation of business for the bank. So it's not just your frontline teller who stands to make money or who has targets to chase. It's their boss and their boss's boss. Let me switch a little now. I have a serious problem with this framing of TD as the wolf or the exception to the rule. because this framing isn't quite as benign as it looks. The most significant consequence of the lone wolf myth is that it subsumes the very real and the much larger problems which are implicated in this particular model of financial policing through banks. First of all, asking civilian institutions to police other citizens, it poses a series of serious legal, constitutional, and ethical issues, including an impact on civil liberties. Second, there is also a serious conflict of interest issue because the banks have a profit imperative undergirding all their actions. When we paint TD as an exception, we essentially gloss over the underlying legal and ethical problems, but also the fact that we have a compromised, conflicted institution that is tasked with policing us. Third, and this is, I think, the most problematic piece in this, once we characterize exception, we narrow our conception of aberrant behavior, as well as the range of corrective punishments that are merited. We end up with new, entirely subjective determinations of who should be punished and how they should be punished. Let me put this in context. This chart is a breakdown of the composition of illicit financial flows across the world in a given year. As you can see, crime makes up less than 1/3 of this pie. That's the chart on the left. And drugs trafficking is an even smaller component of that 30%. The rest of the pie comprises dodgy corporate behavior, including trade-related malpractices and tax abuse, which is tax evasion as well as tax avoidance. Now, when we hold up TD as the exemplar of laundering, we reinforce this notion that money laundering is mostly about criminal activity, and it's not about the tax avoidance that we see Apple or Microsoft doing. But then we drill down further and we conclude about TD that it was a few bad apples within TD that were able to launder because the bank lacked effective technology to screen unused transactions. This is significant because in this moment, we are deciding that laundering is a one-off isolated event, and we don't need to look at the systemic inducements towards laundering within the broader financial industry. For those of you who've been reading about the TD story, once we buy into corporate culture and or bad governance as the root cause of laundering, we start ignoring the very real financial incentive for banks to launder money. As long as we continue blaming TD's culture and its board of directors, we cannot appreciate that the supposed financial system to laundering are in fact endemic and systemic. They are not spontaneously occurring accidents. They are a carefully curated design feature. Now, with this, accordingly, our understanding of the punishment that this behavior merits, our understanding of that punishment changes. As one plucks out the bad apples from the barrel, so we've seen a few lower level TD employees jailed. We've seen a few people who were higher up in the corporate hierarchy. We've seen them randomly disappear, and the board of directors is recomposed. This, we are told, is TD being held accountable. Now, I've never been lucky enough to work for companies that offer performance-linked bonuses or stock options. But even I know how one exits from a company determines the extent of impact on one's personal finances. When someone leaves for undisclosed reasons, like TD's chief compliance officer, or because they are retiring, like TD's global chief or auditor and its CEO, the financial implications of this exit are far less severe than they would have been if that person had been fired just because. By the way, I don't know if any of you have seen that wonderful story in the Globe and Mail, which estimates the value of the exiting CEO's stock options. Now, given this, forgive me for being the Debbie Downer here, but I'm not persuaded that this is truly TD being held accountable. I'm also equally unimpressed by the recomposition of the TD board in line with the deal that TD cut with US regulators. The new directors, we're told, are going to bring deep international expertise. They're going to have AML experience, and they're going to have ties to US regulators. And so we're told, or the rumors are, that the new board will have former compliance and accounting executives from Morgan Stanley, as well as JP Morgan Chase. These sound like wonderful choices, except for the fact that both these banks have been implicated in money laundering issues in just 2024. JP Morgan was identified in a money laundering racket in March last year, and in November 2024, one-fourth of Morgan Stanley's international accounts were being identified as being at high risk for money laundering. And that's from a Wall Street Journal story. Now, there are several layers of irony here. Some of you may be familiar with the Basel AML index. This is an index which measures a country's vulnerability to money laundering, as well as its capacity to respond to that risk. Now, according to the latest iteration of the index, Canada is 20 places ahead of the US. Being schooled by the US on how to deal with money laundering risk then becomes slightly amusing. Being told by US regulators to choose directors from American financial institutions that are at the cutting edge of money laundering innovation then becomes laughable. There is an element within corporate Canada that suffers from what I like to call anxiety or perceived anxiety regarding Canadian provincialism vis-a-vis their US counterparts. I am thinking of this Globe and Mail story about how the old board, which was so terrible and oversaw all this laundering activity, they comprised people primarily at the Toronto Club. But on the flip side, a new set of directors with US experience is unlikely to deliver the outcomes that are being imagined or being thought of at present, simply for the reasons that we've discussed. When the TD story broke in May last year, we saw even a bunch of the most sensible commentators in Canada demand that Canadian regulators and law enforcement agencies ought to fall on their shame. This is a popular view in the mainstream media. But we need to remember two points here. First of all, we need to be sensible of how our banking industry is structured. In an oligopolistic banking environment like we have in Canada, Punishing TD severely is not really an option. There is just too much riding on it politically. And of course, some of you will remember how we dealt with SNC-Lavalin when we discovered that they were engaging in bribery and corruption abroad. TD is to pay US regulators $3 billion US dollars, while within Canada, they've only recently been asked to pay a $9 million, this is Canadian dollars, penalty to FINTRAC. And this is because our law says that when FINTRAC is imposing penalties on anyone, they're supposed to consider their ability to pay. Even in the new raft of regulations that were outlined in the fall economic statement of 2024, the maximum penalty being advocated is 20 million or 3% of the annual gross revenue. The dramatic difference between the US penalties and the Canadian penalties is being played up a lot in the media. However, we need to understand that this difference exists because of the political leverage that TD wields within Canada. And debating regulatory harakiri isn't going to solve that political problem. The second point I want to make clear that is about the nature of policing financial crime. US law enforcement agencies pursue money laundering aggressively. They pursue money launderers aggressively because they get to take home a cut of what is recovered. Our laws and our law enforcement agencies are not designed around such financial inducements. And we need to bear that in mind. The final piece I want to leave you with is my own anxiety regarding the future legal landscape. Moments such as TD are significant because they authorize departures from the legal norms that we are familiar with. The exceptional nature of the triggering event, it's often seen as justification for exceptional measures. And so it's been with TD as well. The changes to the penalty structure that we saw in the fall economic statement of 2024, that is the cosmetic piece to my mind. The true proposed regulations lies in the far more invasive financial surveillance strategies that they endorse. One of these is the requirement that all reporting entities share information with each other, which means that my bank, my accountant, my realtor, my mortgage broker, and my jeweler, everyone gets to pool information about me that gets reported to FINTRAC and other government agencies. But then FINTRAC will also provide this information to Elections Canada and provincial asset forfeiture regimes. One could argue here, what does a mild-mannered law professor have to fear from such a process? And to that, I'd say just this. What has a mild-mannered law professor done to merit invasive surveillance? There are a host of significant constitutional issues with the provincial civil regime, which will be compounded further by these new regulations. But when the dust settles, will we remember how the TD story played into all of this? That's all I have for now. I'd like to take any questions if there are any. I think I'm within time. Yep.
Yeah.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for